Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this event. Let's get the show on the road. Welcome to the LSE for this public event, which is hosted by the Department of Geography and Environment and co-hosted with the Feroz Lajli Institute for Africa. My name is Gareth Jones, and I'm Professor of Urban Geography here at the LSE. And I'm very pleased to be here to welcome you and to welcome Claire Mercer, Deborah James, Sue Parnell, and Ola Oduku to our audience here in the auditorium and online. To introduce very briefly the four speakers, Claire Mercer is human geographer working at the intersection of human geography and African studies. Her early work developed a critique of the NGOization of development, and subsequent work developed post-colonial approaches to civil society and diaspora. She's currently working on new research on peripheral urbanization in African cities. Sue Parnell is Global Challenges Research Professor in the School of Geography at the University of Bristol, an emeritus professor at the African Centre for Cities at the University of Cape Town. Deborah James is an anthropologist and academic who specialises in South Africa, economic anthropology, political anthropology, and ethnography. Since 2008, she's been professor of anthropology here at the LSE. And Ola Oduku is a British African architect who is head of the school at Liverpool School of Architecture. Today we're here to discuss Claire's new book, The Suburban Frontier, Middle Class Construction in Dar es Salaam. But for now, I'm truly delighted to hand over to Claire Mercer to introduce her book, and then we will pass comment to Sue, to Deborah, and to Ola, each in turn, before Claire has a chance to respond to their comments, and then we'll open up to questions, as I've said. So, without further ado, Claire.
Thank you, Gareth, and thank you all for being here this evening to launch this book. I want to begin with this image. It's the cover of the book, and I want to begin with it because it captures the spectacular and the ordinary nature of what has unfolded on Dar es Salaam's northern periphery over the last 2.5 decades. It's spectacular because the land on which these houses have been built was farmland until the turn of the 21st century. And as recently as the 1990s, Dar es Salaam's northern hinterland was sparsely populated by a patchwork of farms, farmed by indigenous Zaramo, who tended cashew and coconut trees, and small farms owned by urbanites who grew fruit and vegetables for local markets. Just 2 decades later, the transformation of this hinterland into low-density, desirable residential neighbourhoods was well underway as urbanites sought affordable land on which to build the house to which they aspired. It's also ordinary, middle-class suburban life that seems to embody a global suburban ideal, close enough to benefit from the city's economy and social life, but far enough from the city to have space outside to grow one's family. But these suburban neighbourhoods are also distinctive in significant ways. And perhaps most importantly, they're being developed through the repetition of thousands of individual cash-based domestic building projects rather than through large-scale financialised property development. This suburban zone is mostly lacking tarmac roads and, as you can see, bulk drainage, sanitation and piped water. These are, in fact, mostly informal settlements, but not as they've been commonly represented in African cities. Most residents may lack formal legal titles to the land they occupy, but that hasn't stopped them from making substantial investments in their suburban property. Over the last 2 decades, people have transformed Dar es Salaam's periphery. And when I first encountered these new residential neighbourhoods in 2012, where I had previously known a rural landscape, they prompted a series of questions for me. Who's building these houses? What kind of urban space is being constructed? And what does this mass auto-construction on the city's former peri-urban edge tell us about how African cities and societies are changing? The suburban frontier addresses these questions. It examines the transformation of Dar es Salaam's periphery since the late 19th century, from rural hinterland to peri-urban fringe to suburban frontier. And it does so from the vantage point of one neighbourhood, which you can see in the map. It's about 25 kilometres to the north, Salasala. And that's where I conducted qualitative and ethnographic fieldwork with house builders and residents on multiple research trips between 2012 and 2022. Starting in the last third of the 19th century, the land farmed by the Zaramo was enclosed, alienated, nationalised, enclosed again and commodified as it was claimed by Arab and European investors, then colonial and post-colonial governments, and then farmers and urban residents. So by the early 2000s, most remaining Zaramo had been dispossessed through hundreds of individual informal market transactions. In their place, a mosaic of the urban poor and the lower, middle and upper middle classes had transformed this formerly rural hinterland into a residential suburban frontier. By the mid-2010s, as land prices climbed ever higher, savvy residents were anticipating where the next suburban frontier might develop beyond places like Salasala, and they were buying rural land in neighbouring districts, fully expecting that the suburban frontier would come to them in the near future. But there's more to this story than simply a narrative about changing land use on the urban periphery. The central aim of the book is to examine the suburban frontier as the place where Africa's middle classes are being shaped. Drawing on the long tradition of socio-spatial dialectical thinking in human geography, I argue that Dar es Salaam's middle classes are building distinctive suburban landscapes, and that those landscapes in turn shape what middle classness is. Suburban space is not just an inert backdrop for the ready-made middle classes, nor is it an inevitable step on a linear and universal path of urban development. And thinking with socio-spatial dialectics enables us to see space and society as dynamically co-constituted in a particular time and place. By spatialising our understanding of the dynamics of middle class formation, I show how investment in property, in which I include land, houses and landscapes, how that's central to middle class formation and urban futures in Africa. Africa's urban population is projected to triple between 2018 and 2050 to 1.5 billion people, and most of these urban residents will make their lives in these extensive neighbourhoods beyond the central city. In Dar es Salaam, a city that's projected to grow from just over 6 million inhabitants in 2018 to over 10 million by 2030 to become one of Africa's five megacities, this process is already underway as the population residing in peripheral areas is growing faster than it is in central areas. Much of this urban extension is residential in character and peppered with many small businesses, industries and retail outlets, often located in people's homes. This is organic suburbanisation, constructed, extended and improved incrementally as thousands of individual cash-based domestic building projects take shape. It's also highly unequal. The majority of peripheral residents will have to build their own homes, but only a minority will be able to build a comfortable house like the one you saw in the previous photograph. As Africa's urban peripheries are slowly transformed, new ways of being middle class become possible and new forms of socio-spatial inequality are emerging. Understanding how these processes are unfolding on the suburban frontier is vital for thinking about the future of Africa's cities and the spatiality of urban inequality. In the last minutes that I have, I want to briefly outline to you the three main arguments of the book. The first contribution of the book is to develop the concept of the suburban frontier as a way of understanding an important dynamic of contemporary urbanisation in Africa. And I use the suburban frontier to conceptualise the urban periphery as a dynamic zone of domestic investment in residential property. The suburban frontier is a zone of commodification, of dispossession, of accumulation, of risk, aspiration and experimentation. That is especially productive for middle class formation. The middle classes have been the principal beneficiaries of the commodification of land and the enclosure of plots. accumulating assets in the form of land that can be built on, loaned or sold, and houses that can be lived in or rented out. And this image here on the left is a handmade sign advertising plots for sale in a rural area or on the edge of the city. The suburban frontier is also a zone of aspiration where the middle classes seek to consolidate their social position through the aesthetic value of the architecture and landscapes they're creating. In building desirable residential space that has pushed into the city's rural hinterland, the middle classes have transformed the landscape from these scattered farms and bush into a sea of small-scale self-built houses on individual plots. The relative size, the quality, and the lower densities of these buildings, together with the attention paid to architectural design and the use of new building materials, has produced what residents consider to be a desirable suburban landscape when compared with both the congested inner city neighbourhoods and the scattered, poorer quality of the peri-urban fringe that lies beyond the suburban zone. Yet, their property is also at risk here, where the statutory land tenure of the city bleeds into the customary land tenure that prevails in the formerly rural hinterland. Middle-class experience on the suburban frontier is shaped by the twin possibilities for accumulation and loss. Property is always open to contestation from neighbours or strangers, or reclamation by the state under eminent domain, and a great deal of time and money goes into trying to secure property on the suburban frontier. And finally, this is a social and cultural frontier. Here, the new middle classes are pioneering suburban lifestyles around new consumption practices and privatised leisure, transport and social services. By way of the private car, food is purchased in supermarkets, children are schooled in English medium private schools, religious services are attended in newly constructed places of worship, and weddings are celebrated in expensive private hire halls, all without having to enter the city's historic urban core. For the middle classes, life is increasingly lived on the suburban frontier. And what the book does is it takes different aspects of this suburban frontier, with chapters dealing with land, landscapes, houses, and lifestyles. The second key contribution of the book is to flesh out an approach to analysing middle class formation in Africa as a process of property accumulation. Amidst the enthusiasm for Africa rising, in 2011, the African Development Bank produced estimates of the size of the middle class in 44 African countries. Tanzania had one of the smallest middle classes on the continent, around 2.9% of the population categorised as middle class, which for the African Development Bank meant a daily per capita expenditure between $4 and $20. And they estimated that just over 12% could be categorised as what they called the middle and floating classes, with a daily per capita expenditure between $2 and $20. But as I show in the book, by the time the African Development Bank had discovered the middle classes in the early 2010s, they were actually already a socio-economic and cultural force in Tanzania, even if they were difficult to pin down. Macroeconomic growth in the 2000s was not accompanied by structural change in the Tanzanian economy. The lack of industrialization meant that the middle classes are not precisely defined by the relations of production and have historically been more dependent on the state for their economic and social reproduction. Agriculture is the largest sector of employment, and while manufacturing and construction offer higher incomes, but they employ smaller proportions of the population. And foreign direct investment has been skewed towards extractive industries that has not generated large numbers of jobs. So the middle classes are difficult to grasp in this macroeconomic picture, not least because many of them have developed a portfolio of economic activities to maximise opportunities and to minimise risk. And those that I've spoken with as part of this research have included high and low level state employees, salaried workers in international companies and the banking, insurance and legal professions, sales managers, employees of religious institutions and universities, business owners, many of the self-employed, and those who've retired from public service. Most people, however, rely on a combination of these different income-generating strategies. Moreover, most of them are also homeowners and landowners. And for this reason, I suggest it's worth paying more attention to property in order to understand the position of the middle classes in Africa. Property, understood here as land, houses, and landscape, slowly accretes into economic and cultural capital that is passed on within families. This approach to the middle class retains the understanding from Marx that class is a social relation that arises from the social dynamics of unequal ownership of capital and property. It also recognises with Weber and later with Bourdieu that unequal class relations are reproduced through culture. In the book, cultural capital is explored through the aesthetic power of domestic architecture, suburban landscapes and lifestyles. Although, of course, Marx, Weber and Bourdieu were all theorising the dynamics of European societies in historical conditions very different from those that I'm talking about in contemporary Tanzania. And so I've turned to recent anthropological writing that has explored the dynamics of what they've called the global middle classes as a way of thinking about middle class formation beyond the historical experience of Europe and America. And in much of this work, anthropologists have developed what they call a practice approach to class that pays attention to broader political economic structures, but is also concerned with everyday repetition of actions that form the basis of social classes and the relations between them. So the focus on practices is useful in the context of Tanzania, where the middle classes are unmarked in the vernacular. But as I argue, the lack of a collective noun for middling types doesn't mean that they don't exist in practice. And so social classes are shaped by the things that people do, perhaps unconsciously, in the course of their everyday lives. In the book, what this means is that I pay attention to the dispersed yet repeated practices related to property on the suburban frontier. How people acquire, secure, and develop plots of land, how they slowly build a house over time, how they decorate their homes, how they represent the landscape, how they plan for the future, how they spend their leisure time. Land acquisition, landscape formation, house building and lifestyle are distinctive repertoires of property practice through which middle classness emerges on the suburban frontier. The final key argument of the book is to develop the idea of the coloniality of space. The coloniality of space is a way of thinking about how the legacies of colonial urban planning linger in the built environment and the visceral experience of the city's landscapes in the past and the present. Colonial urban planning, however patchy and incomplete, enframed African cities, leaving its imprint not only on the city's material form, but also on how people thought about urban space and their place in it. Today, the colonial is not the only logic of the production of urban space, but it remains as the spatial residue of what decolonial scholars identify as the coloniality of power. It endures in colonial land tenure regimes that render the majority of urban residents as squatters without access to decent housing or land rights. It endures in residents' ideas about the aesthetics of good urban space in terms of topography, planning, and architecture. And you can see two kind of contrasting landscapes here that are seen on the left-hand side as desirable and on the right-hand side less desirable, too cramped. And in fact, that person was building somewhere further out already at the time I took this image. It endures in colonial land tenure regimes that render the majority of urban residents as squatters without access to decent housing or land rights. It endures in terms of ideas about topography, planning, and architecture. And the coloniality of space endures in a hierarchical way of thinking about urban space, in which some places are better than others, and people higher up the social hierarchy deserve to live in better places. As I show in the book, it's also central to middle-class urban imaginaries and urban spatial practices. The most common use of land in African towns and cities is for housing. Yet, the question of how most housing is produced in urban Africa has fallen off most governments' and researchers' agendas. In most urban areas, residents fashion their own living spaces in the interstices by building or renting. This is a form of urban space making that is small scale and cash based, yet widely repeated across the continent. And as I show in the book, Dar es Salaam's middle classes acquire, buy, occupy, use, enclose, or lend land, and they build, rent, extend, and improve domestic space. In so doing, the middle classes make property, raise land values, produce rental opportunities, and slowly accumulate material and cultural assets that reproduce middle classness. In the process, they make urban space that works for them.
Okay, over to you, Sue.
Great. Thanks, Claire. That was really, really useful just to kind of get our teeth directly into it. I wanted to say, though, just to start, there's a reason why you should read the whole book. There is something about the freshness, the wholesomeness, the completeness, the opportunity for nuance and texture in a book volume that you simply do not get in an article. There's a reason we have a book launch and we don't have article launches. And this book is worth reading. It's worth reading, tuck yourself away and read it from cover to cover, because it not only provides us with what you would hope for, which is a narrative arc, you can keep going, the story is clear. It's also helpful that we meet interesting people, we meet interesting places, we come across interesting buildings, we discover things about institutions, but there's a conceptual sophistication that emerges from that narrative. And that's what you generally do not get in individual shorter kinds of articles. And so I'd take it away, put yourself in a corner, get your cup of tea, and read it ideally in the one or two sittings that you can do. Because I think there is something to the craft of the production of a book of this kind that is deeply to be celebrated and to be, noted. So absolutely, Claire, thank you for that, in that sense. It's the first time I've done trying to read from my notes on a cell phone and it doesn't work very well, so bear with me while I go on that. I think what for me, just as you get into it, one of the things which is really useful is that the book takes what for us to places which for most people in the room will be places that they do not go to. It does so with sufficient clarity that you are unable to understand the wider points that are being made. And that's really important because it brings to life, we can't all go to all places at all times. And so it's in the consumption of and the reflection of those who are embedded in those places that we're able to think critically to begin to compare with some of our own realities. So I think that's one of the real values of the book. There's a second value to the book for me in the story that it tells, insofar as I think it validates the experiences of city building in Tanzania, in Africa, for people who live in those places. I think there's a third thing which is really valuable about that, which is that it's documenting critically, but documenting nonetheless this rupture that comes out of this wave of urbanization that is sweeping the continent. And if you go back and you think about the city that we're in right now, and you think about the value of books like Outcast London, which take us to the deep, gritty realities of place, at the same time as they reflect on the emergence of a fundamentally new and different kind of society and class structure, as well as a very different kind of physical form. I think that one of the things which I think the book really does well is it offers us, I kept thinking about Hellman's work on Royard and some of the pieces in Johannesburg and how rare those are. How in 100 years' time, we look back on the contributions of books like this to say, phew, thank goodness you took the time. Both in the field, because of course this is not a product of a week, of engaged research, but rather a sustained process of that, but also in that process of reflection. So I think just to mark that as a significant contribution of the volume. But I wanted to pick up on not the kind of the enduring value of monographs, although I do want to underscore that I think they become less and less a part of academic practice, and we lose the craft of scholarship by letting go of that, and we want to hold it and value it above other kinds of academic production. But I also wanted to try and do something a little bit different from that and a little different from what you were doing, Claire, which was to summarize what the arguments of the book are. Now, a book that is clear has a crisp argument, and you've heard Claire articulating that. But I think something which is of value also perhaps goes beyond that, a little bit wider than that kind of contribution. And I think for me, what sets this apart is that I think there's the beginnings of a scholarship that is not what we would just call interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary, which we also, oh yes, it's very good, nice that it does that. And I think Deborah's an anthropologist, we've got an architect as an architect, I'm a geographer. There is an interdisciplinarity to the inquiry which is appropriate when there are new phenomena that we're trying to come to terms with, and when they're complex phenomena that we're trying to come to terms with. And I think that's there and it's present in the book. But I was pleased that I was also able to distill what for me were distinct contributions. In other words, contributions which are narrower, sharper, more specific to particular kinds of communities. In other words, contributions which go beyond the value of Deborah and I talking and recognizing our different disciplines meeting, and where there is some common place in that. And I wanted to highlight for you, the book I think sits at the nexus of geography, which you would expect as a geographer, African studies, really an area-based tradition that is quite distinct, has a very particular intellectual set of questions, a very particular politics, a small but sharply crafted set of debates, and then urban studies, this much bigger, much more loosely constituted domain of knowledge. And those people don't always talk to each other. There are only a handful of urban geographers who do Africa. There are only a handful of Africanists who do urban in ways that talk about place. Yeah? And so there is value in this nexus and in bringing these communities together. But I thought that for me, what I took also from the book was the idea, the resurrection for geographers and the relocation of what is an otherwise essentially very largely European tradition of writing about landscape. It also brought it into the urban domain. And I think, Claire, that teasing through of kind of people, places, institutions, the insertion of the ambiguities of land, land ownership, land control, but of the physicality of the earth that leads to and must be controlled in order to be settled, really does build on that geographical tradition of landscape. So it both builds on and challenges that. And I celebrated that as a geographer. Claire knows this, but and some of the rest of you may not, but I like the fact that I don't think of Claire, well, I'm beginning to think of her as an urban geographer. I think of her as an Africanist. I think of myself as an urbanist who happens to do Africa. But of course there's that coming together, and the real value of the book is to have that detailed, ethically, linguistically, socially, culturally grounded tradition of African studies brought to the study of the city in the African context. And I think particularly north of the Limpopo, that is relatively new. And so a massive contribution in that regard. And then finally, with respect to urban studies, I mean, I suppose the thing is the freshest thing, is the thing you're talking about most directly and sharply in your presentation, is this idea of what does the middle class mean? Mm. How do we understand the middle class? And what is the relationship to class formation, accumulation, financialization, built form change that we have there? So for me, really, really valuable contributions there. I mean, I've got loads of questions there. I mean, I know that you've been working on Tanzania for a long time. I know that there are lots of other people working in other places. I found your approach really quite fresh, partly because it was driven by questions presented by the visual and the material encounter with a place. You had to be there to see it, to say, oh my word, what is happening here? And you sort of could read that landscape already because you knew something about it. Could you have done it in another place? Can other people do it? How quickly can you get to that? Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about the transferability of the methodology that is nascent in the book that is there? But yeah, I'm going to hand over to Deborah.
Great, thank you very much. I've enjoyed reading this book a lot, so let me try and give a tiny little taste of that. So I think this book finds its place among a sort of growing literature on the African middle class. And just to spew out a few names, Kalola Lentz and Isidore Lobneba, a book called Imagining Futures, Jason Sumich, The Middle Class in Mozambique, Daniel Turt, The Lumumba Generation about the Congo, and then with more of an emphasis on the built environment, like Claire's book, Claudia Gastro. Now, all of these people are generously thanked in the introduction. So Claire knows how and where she fits, but she's also made a very novel contribution to this whole field. So it's a fascinating area for discussion and debate. What these books, and particularly Claire's book, brings to the fore is a fascinating contradiction, and that is the fact that this middle class in Africa, quite a rapidly growing thing of not very many generations' existence, has been utterly dependent on the state for bringing it into being. And all these books reiterate this in different ways. And so, in a sense, its emergence became possible, partly because of the colonial state and then because of various forms of accumulation that happened since then. And yet, there's a huge daily struggle involved to actually be middle class. So, on the one hand, it's been sort of structurally facilitated, but on the other hand, there's this extraordinary effort. And you can see this from all the little stories in the book. The book's full of amazing ethnographic vignettes. Starts off with a vignette about a family showing their day and how they get up in the morning and what they do and how long it takes them to get to work from this rather remote place, how long it takes them to get back again. It's an effort. I mean, many of us know this. Many of us also commute in and out of London, but it feels as though somehow there's just less support for people in this position. And that makes the whole thing very poignant, because these people are not just some sort of bureaucratic bourgeoisie, which is a term that you do use, kind of sitting on their laurels and being all complacent. Actually, they really have to work hard to get their whole position in life. And so you don't feel disparaging of them, you know, when you read about them. You don't think, oh, they're just middle class. I mean, really, who's interested in the middle class? They're all the same around the world. So the daily struggle involved is, first of all, getting the land for yourself. Now, it sounds quite selfish. These are lands that used to be communally occupied. Then the socialist government came along and they had all kinds of regime changes and so on. But the people who live there now want security. And it's the most difficult thing in the world to get that security. Claire talks about sort of efforts to try and get documents. And there's a marvelous quote that I just have to quickly read to you. There's a person called Rajabu who comes up several times in the book. Now, Rajabu, by 2018, had not managed to secure formal title deeds for the land that he and his wife had acquired in the 1970s. That's more than 30 years later. After the land had been surveyed and approved by the municipality, the application had stalled at the Ministry of Lands when it emerged that, according to the ministry's maps, Rajabu had constructed his second larger house directly over the World Bank-built tarmac road that ran through Sala Sala in the resettlement scheme. He lamented, the maps at the council